organizing this nice event and for the invitation. And now I will just first step back 1 hour in time, jump back to the talk of Stefan, where he asked, okay, what happens when we drop the causal structure? And this is we will look at, so we will try to relax the notion of causal structure and look at the consequences of this in terms of information processing, computation, and correlations. So Stefan already pointed out the motivation to drop this notion of causal structure, namely Bell correlations, kind of. One can also see a motivation to relax the notion of causal structures from relativity theory, where it's known that there are some solutions to the Einstein equations that consist of closed time-like curves, that when a particle travels in such a world line, it would bump into its younger version of itself. And then another motivation to relax the notion of a causal structure comes from quantum gravity, as Hardy pointed out in an article in 2005. Well, a good candidate for a theory of quantum gravity would be a theory where the more relaxed features of the other theories are taken. So you have GR, which has a dynamic causal structure, but is a deterministic theory. And then we have quantum theory, which has a fixed causal structure, but is a probabilistic theory. So a possible candidate for a theory of quantum gravity will be one with this probabilistic with a dynamic causal structure. Okay, so much for the motivations. This is the outline of my talk. I will first talk about causality. What are the usual assumptions that we have? How can we relax causality? And what are the problems if we do this? And then I will look at classical correlations once we have dropped causality, the notion of causal structure. I will look at the computation that becomes possible in this setting, and then at time travel and conclude. So my talk, I will look at classical systems. I will not go into quantum systems, because already there we can see there are some interesting features, and I wish to explore on those. So let's start with the notion of causality. So the causal structure represents cause-effect relations. And so a cause-effect relation is when I click on this button here, you will see the next slide, as I will do so in a minute. And so pressing the button will be the cause, and using the next slide will be the effect. Usually in relativity theory, for instance, the light cone structure represents such a causal structure where we have space-time events, like let's say A, and the future light cone of A. And there's another event C, which lies inside the future light cone of A. So we say, okay, A could potentially influence C. And then such causal structures are then modeled by graphs where the nodes are the events and the arrows point from causes to effects. So traditionally, usually, we assume that these causal structures, they represent definite partial ordering of events. So in terms of these graphs just from before, that we don't have any cycles in the graph. So this is the partial ordering assumption. We don't have any causal loops. And then the definite part of the traditional assumption on causal structure is that the causal structure is already given, is pre-established, it's not observer dependent. I will not go too much into this because this is, as you see, it looks like quantum theory. I will more talk about causal loops when we relax this assumption. However, if we do so, we have to keep still some assumptions. We want to have a theory at the end of the day. So what assumptions can one take? Well, just local assumptions. And one needs to take care of some problems that might arise when we do so, namely the grandfather and the information antinomies. So these are, you can maybe see these two problems as two sides of a coin. On one hand, we have some overdetermination where an effect suppresses its own cause. On the other hand, we have like multiple effects that confirm their causes, but the theory does not predict, and not even the probabilities for which cause-effect pair actually arises. So in more detail, so the grandfather antinomy is often presented as the story of a person who travels back in time and kills the grandfather. By doing so, this person cannot be born and thus cannot travel back in time to kill the grandfather. So we have a logical contradiction here. And schematically, we can see this in this form. We have an operation, a gate, which makes a NOT operation. It takes one bit A and produces another bit X, which is NOT A. And then if it add such a causal loop into this, by this we identify A with X, then we see that there are no pair of values AX exist that would satisfy both conditions. So this is the obvious contradiction that we get from these causal loops. The other side of the coin is the information antinomy, which is often presented with the story that imagine one morning you wake up and you find a book next to your bed and you read it. It's a great book. You publish it, maybe you win some prize, and then you travel back in time and place the same copy that you just found next to your bed. So now what's the content of the book and where does this book come from? It seems to pop out of nowhere, and also the content. The theory does not predict at all, and not even probabilities for what the book would contain. And this is schematically represented by such an identity gate, where we have a gate that takes one bit A as input and produces one bit X, which equals A. And then by introducing a closed loop, again, we identify X with A. And now we see, okay, we have multiple pairs of X and A that would satisfy this equation. But such a theory will not tell us what, and not even the probabilities for what the actual outcomes would be. So when we now talk about relaxing the notion of causal structure, we need to be aware of these antinomies. And as David Deutsch wrote about it, this information antinomy, he calls this creationism. It's like, we stop doing science at this point. All right. So it all started, actually also my PhD, all started with this article from 2012, when I then said to myself, okay, I want to work on this and join Stefan in Lugano to do this work on this topic that was initiated by Czaslaw, Ognian, and Fabio, where they study quantum correlations, where we don't have this notion of a causal structure that I was addressing at the beginning of my talk. And they basically dropped this assumption and just had assumptions of a local nature. I will go into this, but I will just look at the classical version of this framework. So the assumptions here are that parties interact with random variable. They are not quantum systems, they're just classical random variables. And every party interacts just once with a random variable that this party obtains from the environment and gives back to the environment. So basically, a party is described by a stochastic operation. Just maps from random variables to random variables. Then another assumption is that if you have multiple parties, then these parties are isolated. And the last assumption, which will save us from these problems that I described, the grandfather antinomy and the information antinomy, is logical consistency, and this is that at the end of the day, these parties have some probabilities to see certain outcomes. And these are well-defined, these probabilities. They sum to one and are non-negative. So this is the first assumption that I told you. So let's say we have Alice. There is a random variable that she receives from the environment. She has maybe some setting A and some result X that she can read off. And then she outputs another random variable to the environment. So a party Alice is just described by such a stochastic operation. Probability of XO given AI. A collection of parties, like I said, is just given as a set of these local operations. And now logical consistency is that for any choice of local operations that these parties want to do in their lab, we will never run into a logical contradiction. And so for any choice of such stochastic operations or local operation of the parties, there exists a function that gives us a probability distribution over their observations, on their observations given, conditioned on their settings. And we can assume that this function is linear in the choice of the local operation, since this would then agree with what we observe. So if Alice can do one operation, or she can do does and sees some outcome, or if she does another operation and sees some other outcome, now if she takes a convex combination of these two operations, we would expect her to see a convex combination of these two outcomes. When one plugs in all these assumptions, what is the most general function f, we will end up with such a formula, where the environment can be understood as kind of a loop, a causal loop, that will take the output random variables from the parties, process them, and produce input random variables to the parties. And we just marginalize over these random variables and obtain this distribution. However, this environment, this stochastic operation here, has some restrictions. If you would, for instance, plug in just the identity, we would get these logical contradictions, and the probability, and what we would get at the end would not be a probability distribution anymore. Here are some examples what we could model in this framework. Well, we could have a shared state where the environment just produces input random variables to both to two parties, let's say. We can have a channel where the environment produces a random variable to Alice, and then the output from Alice is forwarded to Bob. However, as it also has been shown in the paper by Czaslaw and the others in 2012, we cannot have such causal loops of this type where the output of Alice is simply forwarded to her input, because we would run into these logical problems. And also of this type, of course, and so on. So there are some sets of environments which are fine logically, from a logical point of view, fine, and some which are not, and these we have to exclude. Now, so the question is then, okay, what correlations can we get in this framework? And now if we restrict ourselves to classical systems instead of having quantum systems, the question is, can we get something interesting at all? As it was shown by Czaslaw and also in the PhD thesis of Fabio Costa, in the two-party case, if you have just two parties and you assume quantum systems, then in the classical limit, in the two-party case, all correlations they can obtain are causal. They are not, you cannot do anything interesting. So we then ask, okay, what about three? And actually, yes, with three, we can do something interesting, and this I will just present you here. To go to that, I will have first to talk more about what are causal correlations. What do I mean by that? So for simplicity, assume you have two parties, Alice and Bob. And correlations between these two parties, they are called causal, if you can simulate them by a fixed causal structure between these two parties. For instance, if Alice is before Bob, or Bob is before Alice, or they are space-like separated. So in a formula, correlations among between these two parties, Alice and Bob, are causal if you can decompose them as a convex combination of Alice being before Bob and Bob being before Alice. The third case, of course, we can embed it in the first or in the second case easily.
Right, the case,
yes?
Common cause is subsumed in the case where you have the direct causal connection.
Yes, yes.
I would imagine that one, the third one, seems like it's no causal connection whatsoever.
There's no causal connection between the parties. Yes.
In the case where there's a shared randomness, for example, in the classical case, a common cause.
Yeah, you can
assume that as something that's generated in the first lab and then passed on
yes.
to the second.
Yes, you can see this in this picture. So it's generated in Alice's, in Bob's lab, and then, I mean, you can also the shared randomness, you can transmit it to from one party to the other. Well, to test whether correlations are now causal or not, Czaslaw and the others and his co-authors, they designed these inequalities, which are similar to the Bell inequalities, and these inequalities are satisfied by all causal correlations. And this is one example of such an inequality from their initial paper. So let's assume now we have binary random variables for the settings A, B, B prime, X, and Y. So Bob has two settings, B and B prime. In the case where B prime is zero, we are interested in the probability that the output, so what Alice measures in her lab, equals Bob's setting. And in the case where B prime is one, we are interested in the probability that what Bob measures equals Alice's setting. And this probability for causal correlations is upper bounded by 3/4. So assume also that B prime is uniformly distributed, so we have these 1/2 factors in front. And now we can just assume, let's say, in a structure where Bob is before Alice, then this would be 1, but this must be 1/2. And in a structure, in a causal structure where Alice is before Bob, then this expression could be 1, but this must be 1/2. And any convex combination of those would also remain at 3/4. So we can understand this in the following way. We have the set of causal correlations, and then we have the causal inequalities. So the set of causal correlations forms a polytope. And what is outside of that set are the so-called non-causal correlations. So in the quantum case, we already knew there is a set outside of these causal correlations where we don't get into any logical problems. But now in a classical case, we can ask ourselves, well, does there also exist some correlations that are outside of the causal one, but still that are logically consistent? So does classical logical consistent correlations coincide with causal ones or is there a gap? Is there a world outside of the causal which is still fine from the logical point of view? And here, indeed, this is possible, and here is one example of such. And for this, as I told you before, we need a three-party case at least. We need three parties, Alice, Bob, and Charlie. Assume also that now, in this example, Alice, Bob, and Charlie each have a binary setting, A, B, C, and they have a shared setting, M, which is a trit that can take values 1, 2, 3. And X, the outputs are binary. And the game is the following. If M takes value 1, then we want Alice to guess the sum of the settings of the other two parties. If M equals 2, we want Bob, we look at the probability of Bob guessing correctly the settings of Alice and Charlie, and analogously for the case where M equals 3. And assume also that now M is uniformly distributed, so we get this factor of 1, 3 at the front. And this is upper bounded by 5 over 6. Why? Because if we have a causal setting, means there exists at least one party where no other party are in its past. Assume, for instance, Alice is this party. There's no other party in its past. This means that this probability, Alice cannot do better than just guess randomly, which is probably 1/2. The other's probabilities can at most be 1, and by this we get 5 over 6. Here, however, is an environment that would actually violate, that actually violates this causal inequality, and even so maximally deterministically. And what do I mean by this diagram here? So this is, if you remember before, we had this environment as a box E. This is now, the action of this box is now shown in this diagram, where on the left side I have a circular channel from Alice to Bob, from Bob to Charlie, and from Charlie to Alice. So the output of Alice goes to the environment, is forwarded to Bob, the output of Bob goes to the environment, forwarded to Charlie, and the output of Charlie forwarded to Alice. And I have this with probability 1/2, and with probability 1/2 I have again a circular channel in the same direction, Alice to Bob, Bob to Charlie, Charlie to Alice, but where on every transmission the bit is just negated. Okay, this is one example of such an environment, and one can also show that this is logically consistent. So this means whatever the parties do here locally in their labs, we never run into any contradiction. But then again, we can violate this inequality maximally. For this, I can just go through it. There's a simple strategy to do so. Bob simply outputs his setting to the environment. So this is what I mean here by B. This setting is now forwarded to Charlie. Well, on the left side, Charlie receives B. On the right side, Charlie receives the negated B. And Charlie's strategy in order to win this, to violate this inequality, is just to take the random variable that he obtains from the past, from the environment, and XOR to it his own setting, which is C. So Charlie outputs B plus C, but on the right, if you remember, what Charlie obtained was flipped, so it was B plus 1 plus C. And now it goes through the environment again, and the two bit flips cancel, and Alice receives B plus C with probability 1. This was now the strategy for M equals 1, but likewise for M equals 2 or M equals 3, the parties can just rotate their strategies and always obtain 1. So here we have an example of such correlations between among three parties that are fine from a logical point of view, but still they cannot be simulated by taking a fixed causal structure. Yes?
I just want to get clear on what fine from a logical point of view is. Earlier in the talk you said if I have functional dependences, then there are sets of values that satisfy those functional dependencies. That was your first antinomy. Is that what you mean here? Is that what you're talking about? Like it's logically consistent if I can find sets of values that are consistent with those functional relations, or is there some other notion of logical consistency?
Here, what I had this list of three assumptions. The last one was the logical consistency one, which said I look at functions from the local operations. There exists a function from the local operations that produces that is the probability distribution over the measurement results conditioned on their settings. Well, no matter what local operations the party choose. As we will go to see briefly later, actually I will just mention it briefly, that it coincides quite well with this point of view that there must be a unique fixed point, kind of. So like no fixed point in the cycle will be like the grandfather antinomy, multiple fixed points. This means multiple values that would be consistent with the information antinomy. They are kind of ruled out by taking this definition of logical consistency, where you say you want to have well-defined probabilities. Well, already this slide, yeah, actually. So in the classical case, for at least three parties, but also for more, this can be generalized, we have the set of causal correlations which forms a polytope, but there's a larger polytope that contains this one, which are the set of logically consistent correlations. And the interesting here, the thing which is important here is that there's a gap between. So there exists this world of classical correlations, which are non-causal, but still, from a logical point of view, they are fine. So one can characterize this polytope of non-causal correlations, but also in terms of fixed points. So it's like if you have no fixed point, it's in a deterministic case, no fixed points mean we have a grandfather antinomy where we have this contradiction, and multiple fixed points, as I just also explained, is kind of the information antinomy. So in the deterministic case, this means we have a unique fixed point in the, I have a unique fixed point on this channel from here, from I1, I2, I3, by applying the local operations of all parties and then the environment, and when I get back here, I have a unique fixed point on the whole circle. In the deterministic case. In the probabilistic case, where the environment might be a stochastic operation, not a function, it's the average value. For any choice of local operations of Alice, Bob, and Charlie, if I look at the map from here back to here, the average number of fixed points is 1. This is what one gets as a theorem. So as an example here, the environment that I described, so assume now the parties, Alice, Bob, and Charlie, they apply the identity operation. So here I would have 2 fixed points, namely 0 or 1. And here I have no fixed point because the bit is flipped 3 times, which is the same as being flipped once. And I have 1/2 2 plus 1/2 0 gives 1. But if this environment would be not a probabilistic one, but a deterministic, I would have a single unique fixed point.
Does the idea there that in this circumstance, I could say there's consistency in the sense that if I have a uniform mixture of 0 and 1 initially, and I go through the causal loop, and it's also a uniform mixture of 0 and 1. And so in that sense, I have consistency.
Yeah.
A bit like Deutsch's criterion for consistency with density operators, but here at the level of probability distributions, like or expectation values.
Yeah, but in Deutsch, yeah, exactly. Deutsch needs to block it in additionally. He says, well, since there are multiple consistent states, we just take the one that maximizes entropy, which is the one, which is like the mixture of all of them. And here, yeah, I think you can see it there.
You're just demanding it as the expectation value should be consistent.
Yeah.
Is it fair to say that that's logical consistency? Because if I look lower at the level, not the probability distribution, but the actual value, I get a contradiction. If it started 0, on the right-hand side, it ends up 1. So strictly speaking, I have a grandfather paradox.
Oh, on one side, yes.
On one side. Yeah.
On one side. But the environment acts, well, yeah, it's, you get with probability 1/2 this and with probability 1/2 this. So Alice, no matter what the other parties do, she always gets just a random bit. Well, not a random, not in general, of course not. Otherwise you wouldn't like win the game.
But you'll show later on that even on the deterministic level, they are interesting cases.
Yes, yes.
I'm going to talk about
it. Yes, I will talk also about it.
But this circle channel has capacity 0. What you get is statistically...
Yeah, from Alice to Alice. If Alice wants to send something to herself, she cannot.
But it feels a bit, to me, like, if you're ignorant of whether it's this or that, then from your perspective of ignorance, it seems consistent with, you know, no logical contradictions. But my response is just, yeah, well, you know, from your level of ignorance, it seems consistent, but it's not, because you've just described it for me, and the right-hand side is strictly a logical contradiction. So this doesn't seem like a very strong notion of logical consistency.
If I may add, there will be an example where it's really deterministic, and it's non-causal, and whatever. This is even fine-tuned.
It's fine-tuned.
But yeah, I'm not so worried about fine-tuning as to this strikes me as just being epistemically ignorant of the existence of a logical contradiction, and that's not a very good way of establishing logical consistency in my mind.
You mean because the parts are contradictory?
Because the right-hand side.
The left side as well.
Both.
One party could just flip it.
What is the information paradox? Information
antinomy?
Right.
Yes, but you can also just say, okay, Charlie just applies the bit flip and the other parties apply identity operation, then you get...
You can generate other contradictory ones, but in this particular decomposition, it's only the right one that involves a contradiction.
No, it depends on the local operation.
Sure, but here you've made commit... Oh, I see. If you add the...
Yeah, you have to plug in the operations of the parties.
I see.
And then... Well, you can get both, all cases. You can get left-hand the grandfather antinomy or information antinomy. The same for the right side.
Yes.
But yeah, I think it's just an example that illustrates it a bit, but you're right. I mean, it's very problematic. It's a mixture of inconsistent channels, which turns out to be consistent in the sense that the probabilities that we get are well-defined. And we don't have problems. But so let me go from here on now to the deterministic case. So, where we have a unique fixed point on the whole evolution. And this then motivated us to actually look at circuits. Well, what is the power of this? What can we compute? So by this, I entered the chapter of non-causal computation or non-causal circuits. So before we were talking about parties and that the order among the parties were not fixed, and then the logical consistency condition, so that for all local operations, there exists a unique fixed point in the deterministic case. Now we can go to the model of a circuit model, where instead of parties, we have just gates that are fixed gates, deterministic gates. But we allow for arbitrary wiring among the gates, even like wires that go back. And now the logical consistency condition is that for every input to the circuit, to wires that are open, where we can give an input, there exists a unique fixed point on the wires that are looping. So as an example, here we have three gates, F, G, and H. So I can give an input here. For any input that I give here, the state on the looping wire here must be determined uniquely. This is in accordance to what we had before. What changed to what we were talking about before, instead of having parties, we have now gates, F, G, and H. Before we said the parties were allowed to apply any operation locally, but here these operations are fixed. These are gates that are fixed. So this means actually that in this circuit model, we can do maybe a bit more than in the model, in the correlations model that I was describing before. And the consistency condition, as I just explained, we have a unique fixed point on the wire down here for any input. So again, we can construct a grandfather and information antinomy. So these are circuits that would not satisfy this condition of logical consistency. So here we have zero fixed point. Here we have the number of fixed points being 2 in the identity case. But still, there are wirings that are fine, and we can now study the computational power of this. And to do this, we just defined the computation complexity classes. And in this, for the purpose of this talk, I will just look at decision problems. One can also formulate it for search problems. So in computer science, a decision problem is you have a language, which is a subset of bit strings. And an instance of the problem is some bit string of arbitrary length. And the question is this instance, is it a word of the language? Is it an element of this set L? This is how decision problems are formulated. Now we are interested in how hard is it to answer this question. So for this, we define a non-causal circuit algorithm A, which is an algorithm that runs in polynomial time upon the length of its input. This algorithm takes as input x, which is a binary string, and outputs a Boolean circuit over the gates and/or and not, which are universal, so we can build any circuit, any function based by these gates, such that the circuit that this algorithm outputs is logically consistent, just in the sense that I was explaining. So for every input, there exists a unique fixed point, a unique y, such that if you have input y to the circuit, we get y. So this would be such a the circuit that is output by this algorithm would be of such a type without any loops. And if you would loop the, and I didn't explain that here, but if we label all the wires, there are as many input wires as output wires, and if we loop the wires with the same label, we would get this non-causal circuit. And the condition here is that it's logically consistent. So the state on the looping wires is uniquely determined. There's a unique fixed point. So that's just a definition of an algorithm that takes a bit string and produces a circuit which has this property. Now, if the fixed point of the circuit starts with a 1, then we just say this algorithm accepts x. So this means it accepts x. And if it starts with a 0, we say this algorithm rejects x. And this algorithm decides a language if it accepts every bit string x which is in L and rejects every bit string x which is not in L. This is how complex we can define this algorithm. By this, we can now define just a computational complexity class. We call it P non-causal circuit, which contains all languages that are decidable by some algorithm of this type, of this form. We will relate now this class of decision problems to a class that is already known, namely the intersection between UP and co-UP. Now, UP is a special case of NP, kind of. So I think most of you have already heard of the class NP. So the decision problem is in NP if the language is in NP. If I give you a word X, and if the word is in the language, then there exists a proof that I can run in polynomial time to verify that this word is indeed in the language. UP is similar to NP, but if X is in the language, the difference to NP is that there exists a unique proof. So if X is in the language, then there exists a unique witness or proof such that the verifier outputs 1. This is the UP. If X is not in the language, then for all proofs, the verifier will output 0. And co-UP is just a complement. So language is in this class. It means that there exist two polynomial time verifiers. One I call yes, V yes, and the other V no. That takes the instance and the witness as an input. And if X is member of this language, then there exists a unique witness for the yes verifier, and all witnesses for the no verifier will yield 0. And if X is not in the language, there exists a unique witness for the no verifier where it will output 1, and all witnesses for the yes verifier will output 0. And as it turns out, the non-causal circuits, the class that we defined, coincides with this already known class. Here's a proof sketch, but I think I will not go into this. So here, a known problem which is in this class is a factorization of integers into prime factors. If we think about other models that violate causality and computation models and their computational power, we find that like Deutsch closed time-like curve, they can solve problems up to p-space efficiently. Then were these post-selected models that were proposed. The quantum version can solve all problems in post-BQP efficiently, the classical post-BPP efficiently. And here you see in our model, we can just get into this intersection of UP and co-UP, which is conjectured to be strictly contained within NP. So yeah, this means with this model, we can most likely, well, we don't know whether this is just conjecture, but most likely we cannot efficiently solve NP complete problems. Okay, with this, I now come to the last part, which is just combining a bit all of this together, time travel. I already got into this before by showing you the diagram with this Deutsch CTC and post-selected CTCs. So we can ask now, well, is time travel problematic from logical point of view, physical point of view, and computational point of view? In the logical point of view, we are interested in these two antinomies that was presenting at the beginning of my talk, the grandfather antinomy and the information antinomy. From physical point of view, we are interested in not being restricted in what we do in a lab. So this is what has been called no new physics. So just because I can do time travel, am I just restricted in my operations locally? And if you have deterministic laws, in the classical case, we would like to have them reversible, or at least to be able to make them reversible, to understand evolution as part of a reversible process. And from a computational point of view, we are interested in this NP hardness assumption, which actually just states that NP hard problems cannot be efficiently solved by a computer built with a physical computer. It's an assumption, of course, we don't know. But. So in the 90s, this classical time travel was studied quite extensively by people like Kip Thorne and Novikov. And Kip Thorne, he came up with this version for closed time-like curves based on a wormhole. So these word lines represent the two mouths of a wormhole. The numbers, they represent the proper time. So we have the left wormhole with proper time zero, the mouth, the left mouth with proper time 0, 1, 2, and so on. And the right mouth, which is accelerated to some velocity and bring it back. By this, we introduce some time dilation in its proper time. And so in the future of the surface S, we get a closed time-like curve. We can just travel from the left mouth through ordinary space-time to the right mouth, enter here the wormhole, and we'll exit here on the same point again, which is the closed time-like curve. So in their studies, they took this what has been called Novikov's principle of self-consistency, which is just basically contradictory evolution does not happen. This is basically what it states. So we don't have, by assumption, the grandfather antinomy is excluded. And another assumption they took is, or what they mainly were interested in is, if we look at the surface P, which is in the past of the existence of some closed time-like curve, are we restricted in our operations? Are we restricted in choosing the initial conditions at the surface P? Even though at P there's no closed time-like curve that exists, it's only in the future of P that the closed time-like curve would come into existence. And now, so does Novikov's principle, so that we only allow for consistent dynamics, exclude some initial conditions at P? That's kind of the question. And surprisingly, the answer to this was no. So any initial condition, we can choose any initial condition here, there will always be consistent trajectories. And they modeled this with billiard balls. They said, okay, let's take a billiard ball and shoot it in the direction of a closed time-like curve, into the mouth of a closed time-like curve. Can we choose any initial direction and velocity? And they found, yes, indeed, there always exist consistent dynamics and this consistent trajectories of this billiard ball. But what they called the billiard ball crisis is that, in fact, there is infinity of trajectories. So if you see here, so these black dots represent the mouth of the wormhole, which are the closed time-like curve. So if you enter on one side, you would exit on the other in the past. So here, one consistent trajectory is that the ball just travels in this direction, bumps with its younger self, enters the wormhole, exits here, and bumps with the other one, with itself, and continues. Or you could just bump on a different point in space. Or it could bump, enter the wormhole, go through it twice, and then bump again, and so on. So there's an infinity of such trajectories, which is kind of the information antinomy. So we have consistent dynamics, fine, but actually we cannot the theory will not predict us, not even probabilities for what the trajectories would be for a given set of initial conditions. So in a collaboration with some people in Australia, we looked into this and we asked, okay, well, so why can't we also not just have an experimenter that actually observes this Beeler ball, he could also potentially interact with it and change its trajectory. So while before, Kip Thorne and Novikov, they would study the choice of initial conditions at some surface P before the existence of a closed timeline curve, we could also study the initial conditions here, but also any local operation on the trajectory, on the path of a closed time, of a particle that travels on a closed timeline curve. So here L is a localized region, and here now this from point 3 to 3, like I said before, we have this closed timeline curve. But now an experimenter sitting here in this local region, you could potentially interact with this system. And what do we get if we would allow for this as well? So before they would just had arbitrary initial conditions at surface P, but now we have region L and P, and we can ask the same question. And what we get by this is actually, well, I just stated, but I will show it in just in a second. So we get the unique dynamics, but we don't have this Beeler ball crisis. We can make everything reversible, and as from the result from just before, it's from a computational point of view quite tame. So how can we model this? So we decompose local regions into past and future boundaries. So this is a local region that is drawn in blue here. And we just are interested here now in the deterministic case. So dynamics within this region is given by a function. Let's say for the region R, it's a function fr that takes some state from its past region to its future region. And no new physics means we can apply any function that we wish from the set of past states to the set of future states within that region. For three regions or more, as just before, we are now interested in the in what dynamics are possible now. And the closed timeline curve would be of this kind, would be a function that would take the states at the output, at the future regions of the parties, and produce states at the past regions of these regions, yeah. At the past surfaces of the regions. So a closed timeline curve is like this. So there's a state going to region R, S, and T. Then locally we apply some functions, fr, fs, ft, and then the states enter the closed timeline curve and come to the past. So if we now assume that we don't have any grandfather antonymy, which was what I said before, is also named the Novikov self-consistency principle, and now the strong no-new physics principle, namely that not only in the past, before any closed timeline curve came into existence, we have the complete freedom in choosing the initial conditions. Also in local regions, physics does not change, even though we have a closed timeline curve around us. So for any choice of operations in these regions, there exists consistent dynamics. So for any choice is this no new physics principle, which means we can choose any operation locally, and the existence of consistent dynamics is Novikov's self-consistency principle. So if there exists some fixed point for any choice of functions in the local regions. As one can show, this immediately implies that there exists a unique state, a unique fixed point. And this is kind of the proof idea. It's, I think, not very interesting. And furthermore, every such closed timeline curve, which is now a function from the future to the past, that, as I just described, has a unique fixed point, can also be seen as a reversible transformation in a larger space. So we can imagine there's some global past surface and global future surface. And the transformation from here to here is now a reversible transformation. And this is one example. One can make this reversible, as I just claimed, but in the non-reversible, in the simplest case, it looks like this. So we have these three regions, and we have bits on the so the state spaces are bits. And the closed Hamler curve acts in such a way that what region R receives is not B and C. And what the region S receives is not C and A, and for the last one, it's not A and B. So you see the future is kind of depends on the past, and the past on the future. It's like, and it's like every party, what this boils down to at the end is that in every region, we can choose the signaling direction between the other two regions in this example. So if A is zero, so if the state at the future boundary of the region R is zero, then we see that Y is zero as well, but Z is B. If A, on the other hand, is one, then we have Y is not C, but Z is B. A is zero. So which means that since Z receives zero, but Y receives not C, we have that this region will look like this region is in the past of the red one. And likewise for the other regions. So depending on every bit that goes out here, it will decide the signaling direction between the other two regions. And as I just said as well, one can see this as a reversible transformation. It of course also yields to violations of these causal inequalities that I was presenting at the beginning, and it's now of a deterministic type of evolution. And it can also be generalized to more than one party, more to three regions, excuse me. So this means by assuming Novikov's principle, which already solves the grandfather antinomies, and by assuming the no new physics principle, the strong version, we get for free the information, that the information antinomy does not arise, and also that we get reversibility of the physical laws, and that we cannot efficiently solve NP complete problems. So in that sense, kind of one can see classical time travel as being quite unproblematic, at least from these points that I addressed. Of course, they are problematic probably from other points of view. But so this already brings me now to the end. There exists a logically consistent world, classical world, which is outside of the causal. So this world is non-empty. From a computational point of view, it's tame, which came to us quite as a surprise because these other models of where causality is violated are very powerful, computationally speaking. And we get reversible and unique dynamics. Thank you for your attention.
So in this computational part, you said there is a restriction because you take fixed local operations.
Yes.
And then at the end, you relax this again and talk most general, like arbitrary local operations. Can you comment on the relevance of the... I mean, the conclusion was for the most general case, but what you showed was...
Yes, so what I showed is for fixed gates, so we don't have a freedom in choosing the operations. And so this means we can do kind of more than in the case where we are, it must be logically consistent for any choice. Now it's just for a fixed choice, so the set of operations is larger. So the computational power of having a fixed one is at most larger than in the closed Hamler curves.
You get more causal structures, richer. Is this the same as computational power? That's why I'm confused.
Ah, yeah. So we can simulate the one and the other. So it's we can. Well, if we have such a setup with these local regions and the last example, we can go to the non-causal circuit model and just create the same situation. It's a valid situation. And there we know we can solve UP up to UP intersect co-UP problems efficiently. So we can also solve it in the other case. So we can see like time travel of that sense or this non-causal correlations in the deterministic case, the power is upper bounded by UP intersect co-UP. It cannot be stronger.
Okay.
So I guess I have a question. It's probably very difficult to answer, but maybe it would be interesting. I wonder if you've given it some thought. So far you have like three discrete parties.
Yes.
And then one basically controls whether they have this or that signaling. Now, if you think of some kind of space-time situation, you would could imagine them basically continuous situation somehow. And then it would presumably be hard to think of like having something or its swapped version.
Yes.
Do you think that could be some kind of continuous realizations of the scheme? Or
so
that?
Yeah, we had actually some continuous, but at the end, the decision of signal direction was then not continuous anymore. The space of state space could be reals, but then you look at the sign to choose a direction or something like this. But fully continuous.
Very hard to construct, I guess.
In your last example, the deterministic. Non-causal, but logically consistent. So is it the case that there's a unique assignment of values to A, B, C, X, Y, and Z? Is that the sort of uniqueness that
yes.
we demand here?
Yes, for any choice, so it's always conditioned on the choice of functions, for the set, what the values are. So for every choice here,
yeah.
for functions, there is a unique assignment of values. I can.
If you take identity for all three, what's the unique choices?
So 0, 0, 0 is mapped through this function there. Is mapped to 0, 0, 0. 0, 0, 1 is mapped to 1, 0, 0. Right? Is that correct? X is 1. Yes. 0, 1, 0 is mapped to 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1 is mapped to 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0 is mapped to 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. Okay, this was X, Y, Z, A, B, C. So now you say if they all do identity, so this means A equals X, B equals Y, and C equals Z. Well, we have this here. So 0 is the mistake. You can choose any other operation you can find the column where it fits.
Okay, there's on the right-hand side. You didn't just describe a permutation, so
no. It's if the if there's a single one, it's a shift to the right. If it's two ones, it's a negation and shift to the left. This is how this function.
So what I'm understanding is that given that there are strings missing
yes.
the right hand side,
yes.
it would seem that I could define a sequence of identity or flip for each of these three bits. Such that it wasn't represented on the right hand side. Like if I took not identity identity.
No. But this is what the parties receive. They cannot choose what they receive. They can choose what they send.
It's this subset of strings on the right hand side are the only
states that they will
possibilities that for the fixed point. So there's
yes.
certain kinds of strings that don't arise as a fixed point of any choice of these
yes.
functions.
Yes. Yes. Correct.
So this is a kind of new kind of physics in a way. It says that the space of solutions.
The state space is smaller on the past surface. I mean, because they cannot receive any combination of states. Yeah, I don't know. Well, it depends what we mean by new physics. Yeah. But
did I misunderstand what the new physics assumption was? I thought in the context we were introduced to, it sounded like. No constraint on the initial condition.
Yes.
Here, X, Y, Z would have to be constrained. It's not allowed to be an arbitrary.
But these are not the initial conditions. The initial conditions are what are chosen by the experimenter.
Okay.
So if you design a robot to self-construct in the future when there's exists a time machine, Can we program it today to do this, or are we restricted in programming the robot in such a way? That's kind of the... Yes.
So I guess my question is a variant of Marco's question, but so ideally one would like to know if there is a solution, so Einstein's equations
yes,
yeah. correspond to this, but I guess it's very hard. But then the thing that we shortly also discuss, and I don't know whether you made some thoughts about that, is whether one can think about extending this even like for one more party and looking if this can still be consistent. So if I think that there is this kind of a loop, but then I assign, but then I say, okay, there is a fourth local operation.
Ah, I see.
And then I allow
so you
all arbitrary operations for this fourth one, whether this fourth party is still consistent.
Yeah.
Such that, in a sense, I can trace out then that this fourth and
come. So you take this and, as I understand correctly, implement, say, okay, here's another experiment, replace him here now.
Yes.
Having this already. Is it still, does it still
yeah.
remain? Yeah. No, I don't know. But no. I think it will mess up many things, but...
Yeah.
Well, not if you place him here, that's fine, but... if this fourth party can maybe interact with 2 degrees of freedom simultaneously. Mm-hmm.